We are now in our ninth talk on this series. And I thought I would check in with our placard and see what the ninth image has to say in its caption. It's called Returning to the Source. Having returned to the source, effort is over. The intimate self sees nothing outside, bears nothing outside. Still, the endless river flows tranquilly on. The flowers are red. So somehow I have to make that rather ethereal commentary, practical and down to earth. Plus, we're getting way out there where the bull is just way into the hinterlands here. And my responsibility to you, I think, is to make it down to earth, practical. Something that we can relate to, not as something that is so esoteric that we give up on it, thinking, well, I can get to the third image, but after that, it's just beyond my hope, beyond my expectation. In fact, all of these pictures are within our practice. And if I were to point out where they were, you would see them immediately as very accessible, although not always in duration, but in frequency. We can find ourselves often throughout these images, wherever they might be, within a relatively short period of time in our life. But when we're talking about finding, returning to the source, we're really nearing the end of a spiritual journey in its time element. And we're talking about finding a sense of completion in ourself. And I'm going to pair it now with something that I think will bring it down to earth. And that is, I'm going to pair it with death. I mean, wherever we go in this subject, it's going to be difficult, right? I mean, you can't talk about returning to the source and expect yourself to be as you are now. Something has to be given up. Something has to be surrendered here. And so I think it can be very, I think the what has to be given up can be very, can be oriented, we can orient ourselves to what has to be given up when we talk about returning to the source alongside, parallel, the subject of death. Because death frightens us exactly proportional to being quiet. Because that's all it is. It's just ultimate stillness. And we're completely uncomfortable with that, both in our meditation and certainly with the implication around losing ourselves so completely, like in death. Most of us would like to have the bull kind of linger around in the pasture somewhere close to our house, and from time to time look out through our bedroom or kitchen windows just to spot it, to see that it's in our life, but not have to follow the thing and journey it outside of home, because we don't want to lose touch with what's familiar with us. We don't want to lose touch with where we're most comfortably present. And it seems to indicate that that is what needs to happen. And in fact, that is what needs to happen. So how does silence relate to the sense of the absence of self? I think that's an interesting question. I think we can see that how death would do that. Death would just take us away. Death would just have us end. But how does silence move us in that same direction? And I think I can point that out very quickly in an example, rather dramatic example, of if I said, and there was certainty to this, that the world was going to end in 30 seconds, and all of you believed that fact, where there wouldn't be time for you to get on your cell phone and call anyone, what we would find is all of us being very still together during that time. We'd be very quiet. And quite likely very heartfelt. Maybe we would reach over and touch the person next to us. And they us. But very little would need to be said, wouldn't it? And everything would be communicated within the depth of that stillness and quietude. And we can begin to see that we come together in ways that we couldn't possibly come together within that 30 seconds. In fact, our heart would perhaps not even hold resentment or vengeance from whomever we think is doing this trauma to us. It would be a very different presence, a very different way of being together in that moment, that shared moment, because we would be quiet and we would be anticipating the end of our life and we would be anticipating it being silent together. Now, I think that's interesting because most of us ride our spiritual journey with some degree of tension and issues. There's always issues. We always bring up issues in relationship to this journey. This ox only has one direction, and that's towards stillness. It's not riding into issues. It's riding into simplicity. And we want to bring in, how come we don't have enough social engaged activity? How come we're not picketing Olympia for doing that? You know, it's always, there's some issue with us. And I'm just wondering how many times we lose our spiritual journey within the issues rather than in the way that it's embracing all people in a simple, straightforward fact of interconnectedness. And how we want to hedge that interconnectedness until our issue is resolved. Until we have sufficient gender preference or whatever it might be. Because it has nothing to do with that. And that's why I don't spend time with it. Yes, those things have to be dealt with. But let us hold it, the focus on what brings us together, what we have in common. Not what divides us and separates us. For every one of us have an issue. But I can tell you an issue that everyone in this room wouldn't necessarily agree with, that we should even do anything about. And that is, we can say very generally probably that there are more females than males. We can probably say that there are more Caucasians than people of color. But I'll tell you one proportionality we don't even consider. How about Republicans and Democrats? How many of us feel like we should move beyond our own political persuasion and invite the other persuasion in? And yet that persuasion is very poorly represented in this room, I guarantee you. Much more so than people of color or gender imbalance. But it's one we feel, we don't need to be that inclusive, do we? I find that very interesting, where our inclusivity has a biting edge to it. So this ox is wandering straight forward into the field in which that field holds no reference to differences. It doesn't. The Dharma doesn't invite that kind of perception. It invites something completely different. And that's why I want to talk tonight around the subject of death and dying. Because death and dying is personal to everyone. And can hold our attention sufficiently so that we can all invite our resistances to the Dharma through our resistance to our own death. We can see it. Because exactly as I mentioned, our resistance to our death is our resistance to the Dharma. I had a doctor friend who was doing house calls in our hospice program, one of the first hospice programs, the first hospice program I involved myself with in Houston, Texas. And he made house calls. He would admit every patient that came into our service. And so he was out on a house call one day and was sitting on the couch with someone who had, I think, lung cancer or something, and was listening, had them propped upward, and was listening to their lungs while he stared into the face of the person, of the patient. And as he was listening to the person's lungs, the patient physically died. And the doctor was looking into the patient's eyes as he died, as this patient died. And he came back, and I'll never forget, he came back to the office, and I was in the office, and I could see that something had shaken him very deeply, and I said to him, I said, what happened? And he said, I was pulled into the very thing that I'm trying to cure. I'm trying to, not cure, but trying to work with. He says the patient pulled him into his death, pulled him with him, pulled the doctor with him as he was dying. And he said what he saw was, it was as if he was seeing an endless tunnel. It was as if the eyes stretched forever. And through his gaze, he could see infinity through that gaze. And yet there, he also said, there is immense clarity and presence within that gaze itself. And as the patient was dying, the patient became very quiet and still and then died. And the sense of self died prior to the body dying. And that's what held the fascination for the doctor, was that for a moment he could see what life could be for him if he were to release this burden of me and mine. He glimpsed, he said, the ground on which we all walk. And he said, I saw the nothing of the person within the frame of the something, of the body. Right? So you're looking at the body, the frame of the person being someone, and being taken to the absolute nothingness that that frame holds. Can you get a sense of that? You see, I remember sitting on my grandfather's knee when I was very young, and feeling his kind of gnarled hands. He was fairly old, I think. And wanting to know what life was like for him when he was young. And what I was really trying to get at was not so much the details of what probably 19th century America was like, but rather some information about what life is from him that I did not know in my youth. Something about what's the substance, what's the point, what's all this about? We search, you know, what is it like being your age? What was the world like when you were small? We search those questions as ways to self-explore, as ways to understand what our own orientation to our living situation is. And behind the backdrop of all those questions is the inevitable question of what is all this journey about when it inevitably ends in death? What can possibly happen that's so important when from the moment I am born until 70 or 80 years later I die? What is that sandwich between these two unknowables? What is that about, those 70 or 80 years? The Buddha was so taken by that question that before he was the Buddha, he was the young prince who journeyed out from his palace walls. And one of the heavenly messengers that he said he saw while he was journeying out was a corpse, someone who had died. And it so shook him that he came back and determined to discover what the nature of life was when it inevitably ends in death. What is this about? What can this possibly be? Why does death fascinate us like that? Why is there such a fascination with it? You see, I think it's because stillness knows itself. It's the same fascination that returning to the source has for us, the ultimate Dharma has for us. It has something that puts us all in perspective. What we're afraid of is that it will show that what we and how we have used our life to be rather superficial. And because we don't want that fact to be known, we hide from the subject. And we try to make our lives more valuable in the sense of bringing up details or challenges or contentious points. And therefore, if we overcome the contention, if we overcome the dissension, we can somehow square ourselves that life is worth living because we've gotten over this particular problem. But what is it life's meaning when we embrace it, with the bookends of birth and death? What is the meaning of those years, you see? I think that holds something. If we don't look away, and I hope we're courageous enough not to look away, but to hold that question. Because the fear of being who we are is the fear of death. I mean, who we really are, as we get quiet in ourselves. I've been by the bedside of many people who have died, and never have I felt anyone died in which they did not go through that moment of stillness. It's as if everyone has to thread the needle of their stillness in order to leave their body. And how many of us can use our practice directed towards that stillness? How many of us are willing to actually be quiet while we sit and not ruminate about whatever the day has been and the difficulties of the day, trying to decipher how we should act better through the challenges of a particular situation? How many of us are really willing to use our time to come to that still point of the four quartets where the dance is discovered? You see, what this journey, when we get to this image of returning to the source, is about is the nothing we are. And we have filled our lives with the something we believed ourselves to be. And for 70 years, we have danced with that character, with that personality, with that belief of self-reliance. And yet death shows us, and has shown us, as birth has shown us, we came in with nothing and we're going to have to leave with nothing. And that everything else in between is pretentiously chosen for a short period of time. It's an add-on. It's something that is like a costume change. And we didn't come in with it. We're not going to leave with it. But for 70 years, we prance around the stage as if we were it. How many of us, while we're in the middle of that stage presentation, are willing to look and ask the questions about the source from where we came or the source from where we are going to? What is this birth? What is this death? We try to move it in that direction in Dharma by looking at what it is that where the suffering of these 70 years rests, and to start releasing the need for the dharmic reasons for why we have to suffer. And the more we start releasing and the resistances to life, the more simplified we become, and the less image we are trying to protect, and the more sort of porous we are in character and in body. It feels like we are gaining not a heavy burden as we practice the Dharma, but a lightness, a buoyancy, a joy. And that joy is directly related to our willingness to surrender ourselves within the journey of our life, not to add more burdens, more promotions, more images, more references about ourselves. If we take up our residence during these 70 or 80 years within what changes, which is everything, then we can be assured that death is going to be something that we resist quite deeply and profoundly. When we hold on to what changes, the conditionality of life, we miss the emptiness, which is what holds all the changes. And the meditation and all of spirituality has to do with releasing our grip on the changing, impermanent nature of the world and coming back to the awareness, to the presence that holds those changes. Some of us, though, we get caught, we say, you know, after all these, somebody in our life, we have some unsettling drama or something happens where somebody dies or some sense of loss occurs, and we're shaken. We don't know what to do, and we think, well, our practice has failed us. This shouldn't have happened to me. I shouldn't have had this death in my family. I shouldn't have had this lump on my breast. But the Dharma was never about not having those things. It was never about guiding our life through with safety to sidestep any obstacle of difficulty. That was never assured. It was never assured that we would have a smooth course through this thing. In fact, the more difficult the course, the more the potential of actually learning the lessons that life is supposed to teach us. As someone, I think Shanti Davis said, we are not here to change life. We are here to be changed by life. We are here to release our grasping hold upon the things of the world so that we can move through life without obstruction. So have we taken resonance with things that change the conditionalities of life? I often equate finding the source with looking at a photograph. Now, all of you and all of us have seen many photographs, and we can look at the images that are displayed on the photographic paper, and we can bring forth a whole story that summarizes where we were and what was happening at the moment the picture was taken. And we'll go from one photograph to another and perhaps see hundreds of photographs and never see what all the photographs have in common, which is the paper it's printed on. Because we are lost in the images that were formed on the paper. That is life, my friends. We just go from image to image, in joy or in resistance, never seeing what all the images have in common, the print on which they are based, what is common to all and everything. And that is where the Dharma has always been available to take us, if we so wish it, if we allow it to do that. It is not to make our lives comfortable. It is not so that we can have a little more ease, a little less self-burden, a little more self-love. Those are very nice qualities that will be byproducts of whatever practice, spiritual practice we involve ourselves in. But that's not where the ox is moving. The ox is moving back to the source. It's pointing to the paper, not the print. And the print, the image on the photograph can be a nice scene, can be a wonderfully joyful scene, or it can be in the middle of some turbulent hell that we also remember. But the print, the paper, holds none of that. And is independent, although it's printed on the paper. The paper is not impacted by the image or the circumstances of that image. This is where the meditation is meant to drive us. This is where its pointing is indicating. This is where it's trying to say, in so many words, be of the world. Be in the world, but not of the world. Be in the world, but not of the world. Be a fully embodied image, but know that the paper is the source. Is the source. And so, someone who is very interested in moving this ox in the direction that it needs to go, and is riding the ox to coming home, leisurely on the back of the ox, carefree in concerns, although fully embodied in the world, is full of joy, not sorrow. Focusing on the images keeps us very contested with one image opposed to another. Being embodied within the paper, there is the joy of the collected oneness. Another quality of death that I like very much is that it doesn't hold time. Death, you can say, is the ending of time, isn't it? The mind, with its thinking, is the time machine. It thinks about the past, it thinks about the present, it thinks about the future. That mind is what dies. What happens at the moment that the mind, with its memory, with its planning, with its regret, ends? What is that moment like when time stops? That is the moment of death. The question is, do we have to wait until the mind dies before we can know that moment in which time stops? Because the deathless, and the Buddha talked about the source as the deathless, the Buddha meant that moment in which time stops. Because once time has stopped, death can't enter anymore. It's taken away the one thing that it can, and that's time, the mind of time. Once that happens, what remains cannot die. Because it has no, there's no time associated with it. What we are trying to do in meditation is to move ourselves into the deathless by seeing how time is a fabrication of the mind and does not have to be believed. It's just the thinking process. It's just me embedded within the thought of the future or the thought of the past. And if I'm quiet enough, still enough, not invested in time, I can find that moment of the deathless in the presence that is always here. That presence that is always here cannot die. Has not, cannot, will not die. It's much like the space of this room. You have people going in and out of it, some leaving, some staying, people aging, some dying, some being born. The space, the room holds all of that, but nothing at all changes within the space of the room. The building can be destroyed, the space remains. The planet could be destroyed, and the space remains. So too, the presence, the awareness, that which is not invested in time moving forward or the time that has been, holds all of that, just like the paper holds the images, but remains unaffected and therefore deathless. It is the image that dies. It's the mind that dies. But the mind is such a paltry sense of me. It's such a low-level identification that when it goes, there's an alleviation of a burden, not really a problem. And someone said, and I imagine this to be true, that death, from that perspective, is like taking off a tight shoe. It feels like a burden unleashed. So we awaken out of our distorted thinking. The egoic state of me is the altered state. The way we normally perceive the world is the altered state. The willingness to come back to the authentic state, what's authentically true, is the willingness to release the trance that we have been in. The sense of me and you is just the way the mind has rearranged the world. It's not the fact of how the world really is. And we're afraid of losing that arrangement when it was falsified by the mind to begin with. And when the mind dies, that false rearrangement also dies. And what's left is the rightful orientation of life to itself. It's not such a burden, I do not believe. We fear it because we want so desperately to protect ourselves from any change that might occur. But all of life is change. And to protecting ourselves from impermanence is impossible to do. So the meditation, we allow what arises as we sit, because I like to bring these talks into the meditation process itself. As we meditate, what does that have to do with dying? Meditation is an act of death and dying. Because as we sit, we are not fostering or investing in anything that might be arising. We are letting whatever arise have its day of life, have its birth, have its day of life, and have its natural death. We're not invested in something continuing. We don't try to have an emotion continue or a thought continue. We allow everything to have its natural expression as an image for the moment and for the lifetime it is. And then we also allow that image to die on its own without any sense of needing to protect it or recall it. And this meditation then is an orientation to death. Because it's an orientation to death and that we're not trying to invest in anything that is changing to have it last longer than it naturally does, what arises around all of the different images and thoughts and emotions that we have is a sense of presence and stillness, the abiding stillness from which everything comes. If we invest in the noise of the mind, we miss the stillness that holds the noise. Allowing ourselves to let whatever it is arise and pass away, we divest ourselves from the need to have something occur, something that we like to occur, some emotion or some experience that we'd like to have. When we divest from any of those wantings, what is left is everlasting life. Life that does not arise and fall. Life that does not come and is birthed and then dies. That's within our meditation practice. And that's why I say that every one of us returns to the source in a moment of pure meditation. Is that so terrifying? Is it so terrifying to let ourselves just be what we are, have whatever life and expression of life that normally manifests, and also allow that expression, whatever it is, whatever experience that might be arising, to decay and to fall away? That's all meditation is. That's the orientation of it. And from that natural orientation comes the sensing of the presence of everlasting, something that's everlasting, something that is not conditional, something that does not change. Being quiet together, being quiet within oneself, we can access that. We can get a sense that this is much more tangible, much more available than what we thought. In fact, our thinking is the very undermines the very possibility of our seeing that. And so then we begin to get very interested, not in what changes, not in the experience, having a good experience in meditation, because a good experience will die and then the next experience will come which won't be so good. And we'll want what was and we'll not want this, and then we'll be caught in that very uncomfortable resistance and leaning into one and away from another, and all of the ways that we hurt ourselves psychically through our meditation. But if I just, no matter what it is, no matter what experience is at hand, it's just an experience. It's just an ephemeral moment of life that's arising and passing away. What is it that holds all that? What is it that allows that to be seen? How are we able to see that? Why isn't it all dark inside? Why, when we close our eyes, is there this sense of vibrant aliveness that reveals the passing, the coming and going of events, the knowing of that? That's where the meditation is taking us. But remember the difficulty of seeing the paper when you look at a photograph. Go home and look and see if you can even see the paper in the midst of a photograph. It is very difficult to do. We are so trained to go towards the image, to pull the time element out of the image. Oh, Aunt Sarah, I remember this time at her house. We had such a good Thanksgiving. The story comes out of what? An image. The image doesn't contain the story. We invest the image with the story. So too in our meditation. The thought doesn't hold anything. We invest the thought with the circumstances of our history, of our memory. And thereby we miss the paper that the print, that the photograph is printed upon. We miss the space from which these things are arising. It's the space that the meditation is accessing, not the experience within the space. So, what then survives? Is it all just slaughter? Everything that I meant so much to me? No, there is something that survives. There is something that flourishes. And that's the heart. No small thing. There's a story, I like it very much, because I think it shows something very vital. A person who had had something like 14 or 15 years of Alzheimer's and was very demented, to the point where he was unable to move around the house or knew where he was and had to be accompanied at all times by one of his two grown sons or his wife. Well, at this particular occasion, his wife was in the kitchen fixing dinner, and the patient of Alzheimer's disease was sitting on the couch between his two grown sons, and he had a sudden heart attack and fell to the floor. True story. One of his sons started to get up to go call 911. And in a voice that none of the family had heard for 15 years, the man clearly stated, "Don't call 911. Go tell your mother I love her." And then he dies. In that moment, from what I've been speaking about, the clarity spoke, not the confusion. The mind was incapable of coming to that clarity, but not the awareness. And when the awareness was abided within, the discerning quality of the awareness did what was appropriate and also left one lasting wish, which was to connect in love with the spouse. I think there's something vitally important that we may be missing by not looking at the paper. Another story is of a fellow meditation teacher who was with his mother when she was dying. And being a good meditation teacher, he was trying to orient her to releasing, letting go. And he said to his mother, "Just let go, mother. Just let go into the light." And as he said that, the grip of his mother on his hand tightened. Which mine would too. And then he said, "I love you, mother." And the grip released. And she died. There are moments in all of our lives in which we access the quality of our heart. And it's moments in which we briefly see the paper between the images, between the I, me, and mine, and the wanting of one image and what it wants from the other. And there's a moment in which our gaze pans forth beyond the image, and it sees what unites us. And the heart speaks in that moment. The heart speaks in that moment. Let us not be afraid of death. For the death of the body and of the mind, I am assured, only takes us into the awakened heart. Let us not be afraid of releasing the image of ourself, for blocked behind that idea and concept of ourself is a sense of interconnectedness on which all of life is based, and certainly our joy. Okay, all. Thank you. Can we just sit for a minute or two? And as we sit, can we just release the need for the mind to have any particular expression or any particular experience? Can we sense something that may be much more profound . So if there are any questions or comments around anything this evening, I'd be... Yes?
Oh, just a comment. Was I the only one sitting here thinking when you said we had 30 seconds, we knew for a fact we'd be gone, and we would all just sit here quietly on our own? No, I was absolutely gonna... I would be quiet, but I would be hugging somebody else.
Good!
And because...
Right. Well, 15 seconds. The point was that it wasn't enough time. The point was that it wasn't enough time to get in your car and go out and, you know, fulfill your last wishes, which are not the point of the point is that we don't have enough time. And what do you do when you don't have enough time and you know that death is upon us, you see? Yes.
She has the kind of Delta dog that goes into the hospitals for ill people. She said there was a 37-year-old man dying of cancer, wife pregnant with the first child, and all he wanted to do was pet this dog.
Yes.
And then finally she just brought the dog in anyway. She's a quiet nurse, or was till the day. And she said he just instantly calmed down. That was all he wanted. And I think people want to live in that connected moment.
Yeah, see, what I'm saying is not in dispute of that. I'm saying that we will live more connected, not less connected, when we release the tensions, which is what you're saying by your own story. You see, that's where we're going. That's where the meditation takes us, is that to that sense of interconnectedness, that response of the heart, to the abiding interconnectedness that is a given in life. It's not something we need to seek or find. When we focus on the images, we don't see the paper, but that doesn't mean that the paper isn't there all the time. When we relax the need to do something with the images, the paper comes forward. The paper represents the interconnectedness that's inherent to life itself. And when that comes forward, the heart comes out. That's the call and response of the dynamics of that. And so, as you say, your suggestion that you would grab somebody and hug somebody is partially influenced because there's nothing more you can do with images except acknowledge that connection through hug, through touch, through whatever. You see? And so the last expression, it's like on 9/11 when people were jumping out the window holding hands. I mean, I love that image. I mean, it's love it in the sense that the last thing that people did when they knew they were going to die was to connect and to go with it together, you see. Now, there can be a neurotic need as well around that, where you need somebody by you because you're so afraid of being alone. And so many of us fear death because of the sense of aloneness we would be in, and therefore we want somebody to be with us during that time. So that's one aspect of connecting, but a far deeper aspect of that same connection, and maybe at the heart, though covered around by that loneliness, is the sense of to reach. I mean, it's just that, it's just this. It's the Sistine Chapel. It's just two fingers touching, which is the perfect culmination of a life. You know, when I was in hospice care, there were very few people who I, at the bedside, wouldn't just hold their hand the entire time I was with them. Male, female, old, young, gender, didn't matter. Very few people who didn't receive that touch, very few people that didn't want that touch, very few people who, for me, it wasn't a natural thing to do with each person. It's just to hold their hand. That moment, I can guarantee you, was not about the fright of being alone. It was just the sense of accompaniment, of having company, of having the togetherness that their heart knew, in fact. Anyone else? Question is about vulnerability and how meditation accesses vulnerability. And I would put it, just frame it just a little bit differently. I would say trust. I'd say you're learning in meditation to trust. When you reach out to experience and have to indulge or embrace or prolong experiences, we don't trust. We think that our life depends upon having a particular kind of experience with a particular duration. And that the more we can group certain pleasurable experiences together, the better our life will be. And that there, if we ever release the need to have to grasp that, what would be there about life that would ever be worth living? You see, that's the quandary that many of us find ourselves in. And so it's a lack of trust in anything other than what's immediately in front of our eyes being experienced as having any basis to life at all. And when we have that relationship to life, that needy, grasping relationship to life, nothing else can get in. It's like parallel bars that we just move from one bar to another, grasping at one and not releasing it until we grasp the next. The space holds us, but we think the bar holds us. And what meditation does is it begins to show you that free fall, what you call vulnerability, and what I'm relating to is trust, is all around us 360. And that there's this dance of images that are going on that is being held by something. And we're never going to know what that something is, called the source or the deathless, unless we trust enough to release the grasp we have of the images, of the bar. And so in meditation, we are learning to trust. And the trust, if we don't, I mean, it's full of traps and, you know, but from moment to moment, in each of our meditation, and you don't have to practice for long periods of time, for years, to have had just the briefest moment in which there is this inherent ease in the moment. Awareness is there. You're not trying to be aware. There's a sense of being, of something that's much more profound and much larger, infinitely large, besides just your little sense of me. And you look around, you think, why, how did I get here? Well, you didn't get there. You let go of the bar. You let go of the rung. You see? But we then make it into a new rung that we have to grasp. How do I get that one back? You see? And then it eludes us. We have fallen in that moment. We have released the grasp in that moment. And that's what holds us when we have released the grasp. But we don't get outside of ourselves to see that it was the lack of ourselves in which the trust could come through. We program it as part of something we need to do in order to, you see? We go the wrong way on it. Let's go the right way. See it for what it is.